Welcome to Credit Exchange, your weekly podcast for all things credit, where we speak to the biggest news makers and news shapers in finance. I'm your host, Lisa Lee. Today I have with me Apollo Global Management, one of the biggest alternative asset managers and foremost in turning alternative credit into the hottest asset class going. My guest is Tristan Leach, co-head of European Credit. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Tristan, the narrative on Europe has dramatically shifted in the past week. Tell me why this is happening and what that means for investing in this region.
What's so striking is how rapidly the narrative on Europe has changed. There's a sense that we're on the cusp of profound change in Europe, with Germany in particular looking to turn on the fiscal taps, spend dramatically more than it historically has on defense and infrastructure, and with that giving an enormous fiscal boost to Europe as a whole. It was only a few weeks ago that the prevailing sentiment on Europe was just that it was in the crosshairs of a trade war and there was likely to be nothing that could be done about that. And now we're in a place where Europe appears to be responding to what it perceives as threats and potentially in ways that are going to change the investing landscape very dramatically. So clearly, an enormous fiscal boost, massive amount more spending out of Germany, should that eventuate as is currently planned, will be, all things equal, will militate for higher rates, higher inflation, and potentially higher growth. All of those things really are new things that investors are trying to get their heads around. It's a really new paradigm for Europe. And it's very, very invigorating and exciting to have to deal with analytically a new investing environment here.
And it's so different from some of the what we were discussing even a few weeks ago, where there was scoliosis in this region and we were talking about Mario Draghi's report and how there wasn't enough investment into Europe. But now that the narrative is shifting, how do you invest as a credit individual?
The credit market's very broad, and our credit platform here at Apollo is enormously so. So we invest across both public and private markets, investment grade and sub-investment grade, corporate and asset-backed credit. So really, the whole range of credit product is available to us. And so when we see the environment changing as it is at the moment, what we look to do is to work out which of our offerings are likely to be most compelling in this credit environment and where we can play a role in the world that's evolving as it is. I think if you look at the market right now in syndicated markets, in public credit markets, you have a situation where spreads remain tight. So despite the fact that public equity markets have seen material volatility, public credit markets remain tight, spreads are tight, still relatively low dispersion. And in fact, you've seen less widening in Europe than you have in the US. Something which we've felt for a while is that while public credit markets remain relatively tight, there is attractive premium to be found in private credit. I would say as we sit here waiting to see how these changes will impact the investing environment in Europe, we definitely see relative value stacking up in favor of private over public credit in the sub-investment grade universe. And also, and really importantly, in the investment grade universe, where we try and find ways of picking up 150 or 200 basis points over investment grade credit by virtue of the private solutions we can offer. Now, that latter piece, I think, is going to be very, very relevant as Europe seeks to address in a really expedited way its fairly urgent needs for capital. Capital to invest in physical infrastructure, digital infrastructure, defense. All these things are going to need an enormous amount of capital. Often it's going to need to be done by corporates as well as by sovereigns. And we really think that our private credit offering can be a very powerful part of that solution. And then the final piece I'd maybe throw in as well is asset-backed finance. There's historically been relatively little capital flowing into the European economy through asset-backed finance or securitizations. That's something that we feel has to change. Some European policymakers have been talking about potentially changing that. If that changes, we think that Apollo and our funds really stand very well prepared to be providers of that capital and to take advantage of that opportunity set.
There's a lot of capital need, and you guys have a lot of capital to deploy. It's also coming in a lot of political uncertainty. Like, this has been driven by some of what's going in the U.S., Donald Trump. It's impossible to talk in this podcast without bringing up Donald Trump because he's driving so much of the uncertainty, right? Whether it's tariffs or whether it's pulling out of NATO or not. So how do you invest when there's so much political uncertainty that's constant and volatility driven by that?
I think there are two answers to that question. Firstly, is that at all points when we're investing, we're thinking about an uncertain future. So in a way, there isn't that much new. We see the parameters we have to analyze changing as policy stances evolve of governments around the world, as you say, especially the US government towards Europe. But that's the job. That's the job of investing. It's dealing with uncertainty, thinking about potential future states of the world, and thinking for each individual investment we make, what are the downside risks? Where does tail risk lie? How can we mitigate for that? And how can we get comfortable that we're getting paid excess return per unit of risk and compelling risk reward? That's just the job. That's something we're doing the whole time. But then the other point, which I think you're referring to, is that uncertainty certainly seems to have picked up. And indeed, it seems to be a kind of a new game board we're analyzing. And for us, this is really invigorating, to be honest. Dealing with a world that's changing rapidly puts a real premium on the sophistication of your underwrite, of individual credit situations, and your ability to understand the way the world is evolving in real time. It makes investing, if you like, maybe a harder game, but that's very, very invigorating for asset managers like ourselves who've put a lot of store in our underwriting process, the sophistication of our thinking about the investing landscape, and really would back ourselves to be able to identify the winners and losers in the evolving landscape in Europe.
So let's take, for instance, defense spending. Trump has called for more defense spending from Europe, and so it would make sense to invest in some defense industries, right? But given his mercurial nature, can you count on that? Or do you think you count on the Europeans actually being more stable? How do you deal with certain industries and certain investment theses?
At any given time, it's difficult to predict with absolute certainty what future policy will be. And that's not specific to this US government or indeed these European governments. It does certainly seem that the policy volatility is greater than it has been in many historical eras. What I think we can say with a degree of confidence is that the volatility they're currently experiencing, or the uncertainty, I might say, that they're currently experiencing, is starting to shake European policymakers at both the national and the European level, and frankly, to shake European voters, from what we can see in polling data, out of their stasis. It's making people in Europe realize they need to respond to their areas of weakness, their areas of vulnerability, both physical security, energy security, infrastructure stability. All these things are urgent needs and need to be improved. The degree of policy uncertainty on a global level, I think, has driven a fundamental reevaluation of how Europe needs to conduct itself. Now, the policies may change, but I actually think the realization that European policymakers have come to probably remains. Europe knows it can't afford to just behave as if the next 10 years are going to be the same as the last 10. It knows that there is a period of ongoing policy uncertainty and volatility to which they need to respond by taking their destiny in their own hands, to be honest. So I think you can't predict with certainty what policies will be enacted by Europe. But I think one can predict with some confidence that the direction of travel is going to be more spending in Europe on these critical elements where there has been, I'd say, an underallocation of resources. I think it's clear to everyone now that that can't go on. The speed and magnitude of that, sure, that remains to be determined and partly will be a function of the policy that comes out of other countries like the US.
And when you talk about these kind of industry and the capital needs going forward, that seems to me more the purview of IG private credit loans rather than sub-investment grade that used to often back private credit is LBO activities. What kind of a market do you see in Europe? I know Apollo has been a big proponent of IG private credit in the US. Tell me its view in Europe. I know some of the biggest IG credit deals you guys have done is in Europe. So can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So we'd certainly agree that the opportunity set in Europe is peculiarly rich for IG private credit. If you look at the European economy, it's probably, if you add up Europe and the UK, or the EU and the UK, you know, it's probably 80% the size of the US. And yet our capital markets here are materially less deep. Securitization market is a minuscule fraction of the size. So the sources of capital for European companies as they seek to spend capex essentially on all the needs we've been talking about are thinner. And frankly, European equity markets are also thinner. So there is nothing like the liquidity in the European equity markets that there is in the US. So where's that capital going to come from? Well, look, IG credit markets exist in Europe and for established borrowers that they can be a reasonably priced source of debt capital. But for borrowers who need something more specific in terms of duration, in terms of structure, in terms of speed of execution, sometimes even in terms of scale, if you look at things like the deal we did for Intel in Ireland, large scale can be relevant even in those kind of investment grade situations. That was just under 11 billion. So all of these things are parts of our offering that we think can be very, very relevant. And you're right to say that a lot of the most scaled solutions that we've been part of in private investment grade have actually been in Europe, where there's this real need for capital and where the solutions we can provide are proving valuable and popular.
In the US, a lot of the times, asset managers like yourself are stepping in where banks are retreating. Is that the same trend in Europe? Are the banks in retreat trying to maybe use lend in different capacity, thinking of their balance sheet, their risk weighted? How much is this driven by bank retreat and how much is it driven by just pure capital need that there just isn't enough capital, even with the heavily banked regions of Europe?
When I mentioned earlier that European capital markets are much smaller and less liquid than those in the US, of course, the balancing factor is that the banking sector is a far, far larger funder of the European economy. European bank assets as a percentage of GDP, it's about 140%, whereas that number is only 80% in the US. You're dealing with a much larger banking sector, frankly, a much larger banking balance sheet, and there is clear regulatory pressure to bring that downwards. So yes, that represents an enormous opportunity for us. Now, of course, European banks are well capitalized. Many of them have large balance sheets that they continue to want to deploy in their core activities. But asking them to do more as Europe wants to deploy more capital, at the same time, the regulators are essentially asking them to do less, seems an impossible circle to square. So we think there's an enormous opportunity there. We have thinner capital markets. We have banks who are unlikely to want to do more. And we have a material capital need. And we're certainly seeing it, just, you know, anecdotally, we're seeing banks step back from non-core businesses. We're seeing banks be more disciplined in the way they think about deploying their capital. And that creates an alternative capital need for players like ourselves. That's particularly relevant in the asset-backed side of our business, but also across investment-grade private credit. Clearly, we can be a solution that can step into that void.
So when you're talking about asset-backed securitization, a lot of the reasons, problems with that, as you mentioned earlier, is policymakers. They haven't really made it easy in Europe. Do you think this new drive for capital and this sense of urgency in Europe might change policymakers, might put some fire under their feet to change this up and make that an easier market to tap?
We certainly think it should. When Europe needs capital, it seems crazy that the route through which so much of the lifeblood of the US economy pours, so much capital pours into the real economy in the US, is essentially closed in Europe. The securitization market is minuscule for some of the regulatory reasons you touched on. So it would be crazy if policymakers weren't thinking about ways they can open up that conduit, if you like. And we know that they are thinking about it. We've seen in the press multiple senior European figures call for reform of securitization law within Europe such that you can see that market open up. We think it's an easy win for Europe to move its securitization regulation into a place that's frankly more commensurate with the actual risks of the securitization market, and that will enable capital to flow.
How big do you think this market could be in Europe, say, versus US, so people have some sense of how the parameters?
So I mentioned earlier that the European economy all in is about 80% the size of the US, just under. The European securitization market is, I think, just over 3% the size of the US securitization market. So that gives you a sense for how comically underscaled the securitization market is in Europe. Do we think it grows overnight to rival the size of the US market? Definitively not. But it just seems such a dramatic misstep for European regulators not to move to enable some catch-up. Maybe it shouldn't be 80% of the size of the US market, but it surely shouldn't be 3%. There's somewhere in between that we could move to pretty quickly and just open up access to enormous amounts of capital for European companies who are currently unable to access it.
And I know this is very early days, but you also go around the globe raising money to deploy into Europe. So what is the investor sentiment, the fundraising environment? Are they getting excited about what's going on in Europe and the dramatic changes here? Or is it a little bit too soon?
It's super early days, as you say. That being said, we have heard some investors around the world, different parts of the world, note recently that they're particularly interested in Europe. I think they've seen that the winds of change are blowing in Europe, and there is definitely interest in allocating to Europe specifically in a way that there hasn't always been. So yes, again, very early days, but we feel excited about the potential for investors outside Europe to increasingly allocate to Europe. Because if you think about where most third-party money is raised for European product at the moment, it tends to come from within Europe. That's going to remain the bulk of the money, but there is definitely demand from, or at least curiosity from around the world to invest in Europe again in a way that there hasn't been for many, many years.
And in Europe, it's mostly been institutional investors, but I hear that you guys and others have really made some inroads with retail investors, especially Europe's wealthy. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because it's an emerging trend. And why haven't Europe's wealthy been investing more in illiquid products like the US ones and in Asia?
It is, as you say, something that we see as an emerging trend. The wealth market is one that's dramatically underallocated to private assets, especially in Europe. And we think there's amazing potential for managers like ourselves to take on board capital and, frankly, amazing potential for wealth investors to generate better returns by being able to access the private markets. So we definitively see this as the beginning of a trend. It's an area we're enormously excited about. And we are, as you say, looking specifically to raise capital from the wealth channel. I think it's not surprising that the wealth market is maybe slightly behind the institutional client base in terms of their willingness to adopt private products. But given the premium that's currently available in private product, credit market product, for example, private markets products, and given the tight spreads in public credit markets, it's quite difficult to say that it's not an allocation they should be making.
So we mentioned the premium in IG credit. What's the premium going for direct lending, which is the sub-investment grade part that everyone sort of is more familiar with, the direct lending, the LBO financing?
So it's more of an art than a science, I think, answering this question, because obviously you're not always comparing like for like across the two markets. However, there are some companies that fund in both markets. With the insight we have, given the breadth of our credit platform, you know, day in, day out, I'm comparing pricing in public and private credit markets. It's a big part of my job is to assess relative value between the two. And my kind of, if you like, my artisan judgment would be that basically you pick up 125 to 150 basis points to move from public to private at the moment. Sometimes it's less. You know, there are some situations where it might be as little as 75 to 100. And then there are some situations where it's as, you know, maybe as wide as 175. And those things are obviously very situation dependent. But broadly speaking, I think it's 125 to 150 basis points if you're looking at approximately like for like credit quality, approximately like for like scale across the two markets.
Now, Tristram, you wouldn't have come up so high in the credit world if you didn't have worries. One thing I could always count on when I do this podcast is find worries. So what is your worry? A lot of excitement about where Europe is going, but what keeps you up at night? What are you going in the morning when I've got to keep this in mind?
Well, I guess it's the flip side of saying that it's enormously invigorating that we're in a world which appears to be volatile and changing relatively dramatically is that it's invigorating because it's a challenge to all of us as investors in the market, but also that means there is peculiar attention on not making any mistakes. The thing that keeps me awake every night would be the risk of making mistakes in individual credit underwrites. So they're not necessarily big thematic things. It's more, is every credit underwrite we're doing one that is rigorous and robust and leads us to good outcomes? What's interesting is if you have a world where interest rates are higher, generally speaking, that's good for us in the credit market. We get paid more, right, with interest rates higher. But it is the case that when you have highly levered capital structures, if you have high interest rates, it's great that we get those high interest rates as our return, but that is going to mean there's less room for error. It's going to mean there are more accidents. So a higher interest rate environment and all things equal, greater fiscal spending in Europe is likely to militate for higher rates. A higher rate environment, all things equal, should mean higher dispersion in credit markets. We've seen that over the last year. If you look at the default rate, for example, in the US loan market, if you include LMEs and things, it actually picked up pretty materially, despite the fact that you had a year where the US economy was going gangbusters. What drove that? Well, honestly, a big part of it, I think, was this collision, if you like, between levered capital structures and higher rates. And we've talked about this for a couple of years, but Europe had been the area where rates were expected to come back down more quickly. There was kind of that get out of jail valve. That's not necessarily going to be the case anymore. Higher fiscal spending probably means higher growth, though that depends a bit what happens on the trade war front as well. But it certainly means higher rates. So if that's what happens, you're probably going to have a more dispersed set of credit outcomes. And again, that just drives us to our individual credit underwrites, to making sure the idiosyncratic factors we assess for every single credit is right.
Which seems like we're entering a murky world where the outlook is not as clear, but there's invigorating moments because you can get alpha and really prove your mettle as an investor. So tell me your very best bet right now. What country, what sector for our audience?
In terms of where I'd want to put my hard-earned euros to work in credit markets at the moment, look, I've already expressed a preference for private over public. That, to be honest, has been something that's been true for the past couple of years, since probably late 2022, where spreads, public market spreads have been rallying and private spreads have definitely represented a premium. That's true in sub-investment grade, but I think probably the most interesting thing is private investment grade, because as we see these huge capital needs coming in Europe, the need for specific solutions with intelligent structure can drive real spread premiums in private investment grade. So I think that's probably one of the areas where everything that we're talking about comes to pass in Europe is probably going to be where you see the most interesting opportunities. A final point, we're speaking at the moment with public credit markets trading at very tight levels, despite all the sources of volatility we're talking about, and despite public equity markets having really been under pressure in the last couple of days. When there is a moment of real volatility in public credit markets, it is typically very attractive to buy public credit markets into real dislocations. Because of the market structure of those markets, they are structurally short liquidity in times of real volatility. So that would be another thing I'd be excited for. It's definitively not an opportunity set that's in front of us right now. It may become one if we continue to see volatility in equity markets, whereby you can step in and buy public credit markets where there's forced selling going on, which is some of the best risk return you can make. There you go. I've given you where I'd like to put my money on both the private and the public side of things. I haven't been drawn on an individual country, I admit.
Thank you so much, Tristan. It's going to be an exciting place to watch the next few months. I'm going to be fascinated to have another conversation with you a few months down the road and see how all of this plays out. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To get your podcast, go to Apple or Spotify or wherever you download your podcast. Thank you so much for joining us in Credit Exchange.